Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. President Trump and Joe Biden are back on the campaign trail today, and both are claiming victory in last night's final presidential debate. The talk was mostly civil as they answered NBC moderator Kristen Welker's questions about health care, race, climate change, and the coronavirus.
We have to recover. We can't close up our nation. We have to open our school, and we can't close up our nation, or you're not going to have a nation.
Vice President Biden, I want to talk broadly about strategy, though.
You have respond to that?
30 seconds, please, and then I have a question.
No, number one, he says that we're learning to live with it. People are learning to die with it.
Let's bring in our Friday politics roundtable. Rick Klein is political director at ABC News, and Tolu Onuorunpah, White House reporter for The Washington Post. Good to have you both back. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
Yeah, and Tolu, let's start with you. That was not like the first debate in Cleveland. Trump stayed focused. He didn't interrupt. And both men spoke at length. You could actually even call it a debate. But at this point, nearly 50 million people have voted. What was your takeaway?
Yeah, the debate yesterday was not quite as angry and animated as the first debate back in September. But it did unveil a lot of the major differences between the two candidates, as you would hope a debate would do. It at times got a little acrimonious, and President Trump wanted to use his time to attack Joe Biden as a career politician, as someone who's corrupt, who has all of these foreign business dealings in his family. I'm not sure that those punches really landed, especially since Biden was quick to strike back and attack President Trump for not releasing his tax returns, for his handling of the coronavirus pandemic, for how he has sowed division on racial issues. So the president ended up finding himself in the defensive position for a good chunk of the night, even as he was trying to change the course of the race by attacking Biden. Biden, according to the polls, is ahead, so he just needed to have sort of a standard okay night and not make any major mistakes. I think he was able to pull that off. But as you said, with more than 50 million people who have already voted, I'm not sure that last night's debate changed the tenor of the race very much. It seems like we're still at the status quo, which has the president right now behind.
Rick, one of the things that struck me is that there are just 11 days left in this election. Trump did show that he could focus last night. I wonder if you saw any echo of 2016 when Trump was trailing in the polls like he is now with just days to go. And then suddenly he gets very focused and turns it around and wins. Do you see any similarities there?
I think it is the 2016 playbook, and whether he can do it for another day is another story. But I thought even in the efforts to try to define Joe Biden as a Washington insider, as a corrupt guy that's gotten rich off of the backs of the American people, even with the surprise guest in the hall, all of it seemed very much out of the playbook that worked for him last time. I think there are a couple of things that are different now. One is Trump is the president, and he really has not shown very, very, very much discipline. He is the ultimate insider as the president. Joe Biden also serving notice that he is not Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders. I thought his close, where he talked about the character of the two men and the character of the nation, was particularly powerful and a pretty good distillation of where he stands and what his strength has been. He remains a relatively popular figure, and that's why the race has been as steady as it was. But I do agree that there are some fundamentals that are looking a little bit like the final close in 2016.
How about the issue, Tolu, about health care? Here is President Trump, what he said last night.
So I'd like to terminate Obamacare, come up with a brand new, beautiful health care. The Democrats will do it because
he's been talking about coming up with a plan for quite a while now, and he's had 4 years to do it. Was that a win for Biden?
Yeah, the Democrats and Joe Biden in particular want to be talking about health care as much as possible, in part because they know President Trump and the Republicans do not have a solid answer. They know that the Supreme Court is going to be hearing a case about Obamacare next month, and there is a real risk and a real fear among a number of Americans that they will lose the parts of Obamacare that they like, the protections for pre-existing conditions, the ability to get young adults covered under their parents' plans up until the age of 26, all of the essential health benefits that require insurers to cover things like cancer screenings and heart screenings that weren't covered before. And right now, President Trump has been saying, as you mentioned, we're going to come up with a great plan. Just trust me on this. A plan is coming soon, and every time he's asked about it, he does not provide any kind of details or any kinds of specifics about what exactly he would do if Obamacare is terminated. So it is something that Biden wants to be talking about. Trump did not do himself any favors during the debate by giving the same answer that he's always given, which is, I want to come up with a great plan that's going to be less expensive. It's easy to say those things, but it's much harder to actually come up with a plan, and he hasn't done it over the last 4 years. So that is an issue that I expect Biden and the Democrats to continue to push between now and Election Day.
Rick, what about the issue of energy? Joe Biden said this about phasing out the oil industry.
Would you close down the oil industry?
I would transition from the oil industry, yes.
Oh,
I would
transition.
It is a big statement.
That's a
because
big statement.
I would stop.
Why would you do that?
Because the oil industry pollutes.
To which the president said he hopes that voters in Texas and Pennsylvania, Oklahoma and Ohio remember that. Actually, Pennsylvania and Ohio produce a lot more natural gas than they do crude oil. But does this create an issue for Joe Biden, Rick?
Oh, I think that's the biggest opening that Biden gave President Trump. Now, maybe it cuts in another direction, that this was the clearest statement coming from the left of Joe Biden's commitment to renewable sources and less emissions. He's been criticized from some of the environmental community. But the flip side is the Trump campaign views this as a major moment. They believe that Joe Biden essentially walked into a trap by conceding this. And they believe it will help them with a closing argument among voters in the Pennsylvanias and the Texases of the world. And whether that's right, with so many millions of Americans having already voted, whether you can get late traction on an issue, that proposition is going to be tested. I was surprised, frankly, that Joe Biden answered the question. It was toward the end of the debate. He kind of brushed it off, but he did. And you're seeing his campaign begin to explain and clarify exactly what that means. He is not looking to actually get rid of the oil industry, he says. The idea of transitioning away from it is something that's been going on for a long time. And it's now something that he's on the record saying that he, yes, does want to support.
Well, in fact, I spoke with some Pennsylvania voters this morning about this very thing, and they say, yes, in fact, it does matter to people very much there. So we'll see how much it affects the vote. Let's talk for a minute, if we could, more about President Trump. We knew that he was going to bring up Hunter Biden and these corruption allegations, unfounded, with his business dealings, both in China and Ukraine. Rick, just sticking with you for a minute, it sounds like you were saying earlier that those didn't really land the way that the president might have wanted them to.
It was surprising to me that, and it may be a credit to Kristen Welker for keeping the debate moving, but you didn't have that set piece that we thought would play out. Mentions of the Bidens and the Biden family were kind of sprinkled throughout the debate, but you didn't walk away with a crystal clear understanding of what's going on. I think you had to kind of be in the weeds of the story even to understand some of the lingo the president was using. These allegations have emerged in such strange circumstances so late in the campaign. They're hard to get in the ether, but I actually thought the president was looking to do it in a more concise way than he ended up doing. And I'm not sure that is really enough information to move voters. Now, maybe the intention was just to make Joe Biden look like another insider and maybe convince some voters that it's not worth even taking their time to vote. But it didn't seem to me like something that is going to suddenly inject a late issue into this race.
Tolu, maybe it was because the ground rules for this debate had changed and maybe the mute button worked as it was intended to. A lot of people would say that moderator Kristen Welker did a fantastic job moderating this debate so that instead of these types of conversations, you could get to something more substantive.
Yeah, Kristen Welker did a really good job keeping the debate moving along, making sure that the questions were clear and that both candidates addressed the questions to the best of their ability without talking over each other, allowing the audience and the viewing public to hear what was actually going on. I thought she did a really good job. I think the addition of a mute button really helped. It allowed the candidates to at least get across their platform for a couple of minutes before going into the exchange. And I think President Trump's advisors also advised him that the first debate in which he was constantly interrupting Joe Biden and not allowing him to finish his sentences and really kind of verbally bullying Biden did not come off particularly well on television, especially for moderate voters and the people that he's trying to win over. So I think it was a combination of the rule change from the debate commission, as well as President Trump's advisors advising him to maybe tone it down a little bit and try to come across as a little bit more of a steady leader. And I think both of those things, in addition to Kristen Welker's really masterful performance, really helped the debate to be at least a clear contrast of the two visions of the two candidates. And now it's up to the voters to decide which one they like.
Very briefly from both of you, just want to switch very quickly to the Supreme Court. The full Senate's likely to confirm Judge Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court on Monday. Rick, what would you say about what Democrats can and might do to push back?
Well, they're not going to be able to block her from the court. But what's striking is how quickly that vote could matter. It could matter in pre-election and post-election disputes in the Obamacare hearing. Amy Coney Barrett is going to be in the middle of some of the most explosive debates in politics almost from the moment she gets sworn in.
Rick Klein, political director at ABC. Tolu Olorunpa is White House reporter for The Washington Post. Nice to speak with both of you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's get an update now on the race to develop a vaccine for COVID-19 with Dr. Onyema Obuagu. He is the principal investigator for Pfizer's vaccine trials and an associate professor of medicine at Yale University. Pfizer has one of 11 potential vaccines in phase 3 trials, and the company is expected to first apply for an emergency use authorization as soon as next month. Doctor, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
We want to start with the timeline for a vaccine. As you know, it was a main subject last night at the debate. President Trump said during the debate that the vaccine is, quote, going to be announced within weeks. He mentioned Pfizer by name, along with Johnson & Johnson and Moderna. He said, alternatively, that a vaccine should be coming by the end of the year. You are, of course, in a position to know, being with Pfizer. What is the earliest you expect a vaccine to be widely available to the public?
Yeah, so, you know, the first important thing to mention is that no one can know for certain when a vaccine would be ready. And the reason why this is the case is that the ongoing clinical trials are going to report results which are driven by events. So the incidence of COVID between vaccinated groups and groups that got placebo in the clinical trials. We are hoping, for example, in the Pfizer study to have that done probably in November. If the results are looked at and it shows efficacy, those data will go to the FDA. I hear there will be probably be about a 2 to 4 week timeline for the FDA to review the preliminary results and make a determination on issuing an emergency use authorization. After then would be the, you know, distribution of the vaccines. And because there will be limited doses initially, it will be probably triaged to individuals at the highest risk for infection, which would be healthcare workers and, you know, older individuals, people with comorbidities. And so I think that, you know, the most optimistic expectations around the vaccine availability would be the first quarter of 2021.
When you say emergency authorization, who would be eligible to receive it?
So when the FDA reviews data from a clinical trial, one of the very important details would be the entry criteria into the studies, what patient populations were studied. So, you know, for example, if the vaccines were studied in older individuals and did not include children, when the emergency use authorization is released, it will not include children. It would include the populations that were enrolled into the study. So what I'm saying is that, you know, those entry criteria into the study would determine the breadth of the emergency use approval, who would apply to. But I think that the distribution initially would be more narrow than those groups just because of what will be an initial vaccine shortage.
If Pfizer's vaccine proves to be safe and effective, there's still the problem of distribution. And there are concerns in particular about Pfizer's cold chain vaccine because it has to be kept at roughly negative 103 degrees Fahrenheit. How difficult is that going to make it to safely distribute the vaccine eventually to everybody who needs it?
Yeah, that's important because, you know, certain sites, for example, you know, pharmacy chains may not have those cold freezer temperatures available to them. And so definitely will put a challenge to logistics. I do know that the government has contracted large chains like CVS and Walgreens who are starting to prepare for that requirement.
Pfizer's CEO last month said the people who don't take the vaccine will become a weak link that allows the coronavirus to spread. How much does it concern you that some people say in surveys they simply won't trust a vaccine once it's developed?
Yeah, it remains very concerning. Obviously, some of the drivers of this are historical, particularly among minorities and perceptions around clinical trials. but also because of the politicization a lot of the COVID-19 responses. You know, the data remains very concerning that less than half of Americans will accept a vaccine. And if you break it down by racial lines, less than 4 out of 10 blacks, for example, would accept a COVID vaccine if it becomes available. And so what it does is that it threatens the ability for us to achieve herd immunity, which is having enough vaccinated individuals in the community who have immunity. That should be the way that we start to curb and get past this epidemic. And what it also means would be that among unvaccinated populations, there could be, you know, vulnerable pockets, you know, of the community where disease could continue to spread even after a vaccine becomes available. So efforts really have to be ramped up early to improve vaccine acceptance rates.
Dr. Opawago, I just have one other question. Once there is a vaccine widely in distribution and in use, do you think the necessity of wearing face masks to prevent the spread will be a thing of the past? Does one replace the other?
That's the hope, for sure. I think that, again, it would depend on the efficacy of a vaccine. For example, if we have a low efficacy vaccine where a certain proportion of people who get the vaccine will not be protected against the disease, that would be a whole different calculation. But if we have a very effective vaccine that's taken up by many individuals and we start to see case counts go down significantly, yes, then we may return back to normal. But some of the lessons we've learned from this period about staying home if you're sick, you know, if you're exposed to individuals utilizing some of, you know, face masks and social distancing, I think some of those practices should remain and will be important.
Dr. Onyema Obuagu, Associate Professor of Medicine at Yale University and Principal Investigator for Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine trials. Nice to speak with you, Doctor. Thank you.
My pleasure, Lisa.
We head to Afghanistan now, where the U.S. is trying to end its longest war. But 19 years on, after so much bloodshed on all sides, the Taliban are advancing and peace talks are stalled. BBC Chief International Correspondent Lise Doucette is in Kabul on Skype. Lise, you paint a very bleak picture in your reporting. How could it be that the Taliban are as strong now as they were when the war started?
I think almost no one would have expected that this would be the situation in Afghanistan now, nearly 20 years after the Taliban were toppled by a U.S.-led invasion at the end of 2001. It was a time when Afghanistan, the Afghans, dared to dream that this was the best chance in their lifetime to achieve peace. And now, almost two decades on, the country is not at peace. In fact, the war is intensifying, and the country is not prosperous either, depending on which figures you take. It's either 54% or 90% of the population is living under $2 a day. Either way, this is a very, very bad balance sheet.
When you went through Afghanistan, you spoke with many people. You spoke with soldiers, U.S. general. You spoke with families, shopkeepers. Where do you see the strength of the Taliban at play?
What we're seeing across Afghanistan is that the Taliban have been able to move into many more districts where there are either no presence of the Afghan National Defense Forces or small checkpoints which are easily overrun. But what the Taliban don't have, they don't have a provincial capital, and they certainly don't have the Afghan capital, Kabul. So if you take Kabul, for example, ever since I've been here, and I arrived about 6 weeks ago, people have been telling me from on the outskirts of Kabul, in all directions, the Taliban are here. The Taliban have moved in. They're on the edges of the city. They put out videos which upset people that show that they're in control, literally, of, you know, districts inside the city. But military analysts would say, okay, fine, they are there, but they don't have the capacity to take over the city. And certainly not now, when you still have the U.S.-led NATO forces, and in particular, their formidable air power. So I think right now, it is a moment really between war and peace in Afghanistan. And quite frankly, some people don't care who's in power as long as they bring peace. But there are a lot of other people who fear the return of the Taliban because they don't believe the Taliban have fundamentally changed since they ruled Afghanistan in the 1990s.
So let's pick up on that point, because the U.S. went into Afghanistan because the country was providing safe haven for Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda, the perpetrators of 9/11. Does al-Qaeda still have a presence there?
It does. And in fact, on this trip, I have heard from senior Afghan security sources. We've also seen a report by the United Nations saying that the Taliban have not cut their links with al-Qaeda, as they have been saying they will do, and as the deal they signed with the United States in Doha in February obliges them to do, if the remaining 4,500 U.S. troops and some 6,100 other NATO forces are to leave by May of next year. This is why General Miller, when I said, will Afghanistan be ready for a pullout in May? He said, well, you know, that's not my decision, but it is conditions-based. Why did the United States come into Afghanistan? For America's own security. When it goes out of Afghanistan, it has to be sure that its own security will not be compromised again.
So to what extent is General Scott Miller, with whom you spoke, concerned about a premature pullout of American troops because the president wants them all home, all U.S. troops home by Christmas time? What else did he tell you about the advisability of that?
General Miller would not be drawn on that. He wants to avoid controversy. But it was interesting how emphatic he was about the need to reduce violence, specifically the Taliban, but also, he said, the other sides as well, the Afghan forces too, because I think he knows they want this to go smoothly. If the United States and NATO allies pull out and Afghanistan descends into chaos, that's no good for anyone, most of all Afghans.
BBC Chief International Correspondent Lee Doucette in Kabul, Afghanistan. We have a link to her reporting from Afghanistan at hereandnow.org. Thank you so much, Lee.
Thank you.
Thailand has revoked an extreme state of emergency in the capital, Bangkok, that was initially aimed at putting an end to student-led anti-government protests. But as Michael Sullivan reports, it's not likely to work.
In 2014, General Prayut Chan-o-cha seized power from a democratically elected government and vowed to end widespread political unrest and, quote, bring happiness back to the Thai people. He even wrote a song about it. Today the nation faces grave danger with unrest everywhere, the lyrics go. We would like to come in and save the nation and ask for your time and your trust. But almost 6 years on, divisions in society are arguably worse, the economy didn't get better, and there's a military-drafted constitution, critics say, helped ensure last year's ostensibly democratic election was anything but.
The system was rigged from the very beginning under this constitution.
It's a constitution, says David Streckvis, who's written about the monarchy and the military, that ensures the military's continued dominance in Thai politics, in part through an appointed 250-member Senate chosen by the military. But a strong third-place finish in that election by an upstart political party did encourage some until it was dissolved by the government-friendly Constitutional Court earlier this year.
Once the party was dissolved, people largely gave up any hope in ever being able to change the system under the rules of the game.
That dissolution, says Titinangpong Sudarak of Bangkok's Chulalongkorn University, disenfranchised more than 6 million voters, many of them young people.
I think that was a critical threshold. It became a catalyst for them to think that they have to take matters into their own hands. And I think they're sick and tired, they're fed up, and for them, enough is enough.
The protests began soon after, but COVID put them on hold until they started up again in July with their demands that the government step down for new elections and for a new constitution. Then came a shocking new demand in August. That's Punusaya Sitijira Watanakul, a university student reading a manifesto calling for reform of Thailand's powerful monarchy in a country where any criticism of the monarchy can lead to prison time. In a country where analysts say the monarchy, the military, and the economic elite have long been intertwined.
Now it's a new era. It's our generation. And if we don't change that, then we will have to live like this forever, and we don't want that.
The protests snowballed after that, and after an alleged incident involving the Queen's motorcade that ended with the arrest of dozens of protest leaders, including Panusayah. When police used water cannon against demonstrators last Friday, protests spread around the country. In an effort to defuse the situation, the Prime Minister went on television Wednesday to announce his intention to revoke the emergency decree and urged protesters to stand down. Political analyst Titi Nungpung Sudarak says that's unlikely to happen.
The protest movement, I think, will be emboldened by this revocation of the emergency decree, and they will likely build their momentum around it.
After Prayut's speech, thousands of demonstrators marched to his office, demanding the release of jailed protesters and giving him an ultimatum: resign within 3 days. Prayut says he's staying. For NPR News, I'm Michael Sullivan in Bangkok.
Reporter Nate Hedgie from the Mountain West News Bureau just pedaled 800 miles on his bike from Montana to Colorado, interviewing and listening to Americans ahead of the 2020 election. He made the trip in August and September, and he joins us now. Nate, we're glad you made it back in one piece. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and this is, by definition, is an exercise in slow journalism. Why did you get on a bike to make this trip when you could have done it any number of ways?
That is a great question, and there was definitely moments on the trip where I was wondering that exact question because I was hot and tired and exhausted. But I got on a bike because I wanted to slow the news cycle down to like a speed of 10 miles per hour. And I figured I'd just meet more people if I did it that way. And there was also a bicycle moves at about the speed of someone on horseback. And that's the way we experienced the West for, you know, centuries before the automobile. And so I wanted to experience this part of the rural West at that slow pace.
Yeah. Well, I love it. I love the concept. And the route from Missoula, Montana, which is your home base, through Idaho, Wyoming, and then ending in Steamboat Springs, Colorado, beautiful mountain town there. How did you chart it out?
Well, I wanted to follow the continental divide as a kind of metaphor for the political divide. And I knew I wanted to visit a lot of small towns and rural communities because there was a mantra back in 2016 that journalists weren't listening to folks in conservative small towns. And so I wanted to listen. My route was originally going to end in Greeley, Colorado, but there were wildfires. I was also waylaid by a snowstorm. And so I ended up in Steamboat Springs instead, because that was probably the safest place to end the whole journey, considering the fires and all the other weather wackiness.
And the other natural disaster that you're dealing with, of course, through all this is the pandemic. I assume a trip like this, you're going to start planning long before the outbreak happened. But tell me how that affected your trip and how people responded to that.
Yeah, so we originally planned this trip way back in January. I was going to ride from the Mexico border to the Canadian border, but then the pandemic hit. We scrapped the whole thing until about August, when the pandemic wasn't hitting very hard in this kind of section of the rural West, and we felt that it could be safe so long as I masked up and took all the social distancing precautions. And so I did, and you know, one thing you notice when you're riding through this part of the country is that, there's a low caseload, but also nobody was wearing a mask. There was no social distancing. It seemed like business as usual. I mean, honestly, there were days that I forgot the pandemic was even happening. But that did frustrate some people, including this guy, Dave, who I met in Ledore, Idaho.
It sure is ridiculous that we've got political divisiveness based on a public health emergency. I mean, you know, I've actually had people talk about, wearing a mask, you're showing disrespect for the president. What is wrong with you?
You know, that's interesting, Nate, to hear Dave there from Idaho. And by the way, he didn't want to use his last name, partially because he was worried about criticizing people and talking politics. Did you hear a lot of that? People concerned expressing controversial ideas. Here's a guy who's in support, it seems, of wearing masks.
Right, yeah. And I did hear that at least a handful of times. I think when you're in any kind of homogenous society or town, you know, when you're surrounded by folks who may you know, like the president when you don't like the president, or vice versa, that there's a concern that they will hear your interview on the radio and get angry at you, especially in a small town when everybody knows everybody. And folks really rely on helping each other out during a snowstorm or a power outage. And that's what kind of shook me about talking with Dave, is that, you know, he loves his small town because that's exactly what happens. You help people when, you know, there's a natural disaster or when you're stuck in a ditch or something else like that. And he was worried that people maybe wouldn't help him because of his politics, because he was wearing a mask and things like that.
You know, Nate, we're in such a moment in this country right now. The pandemic is going on, yes, but there's so many other things happening. What else did you hear? What other issues were important to people?
Growth and affordability change was something that everybody brought up in this part of the country, because the Mountain West is the fastest growing region in the nation. It's essentially gentrifying. You know, we've got rich people and remote workers from cities that have been buying up houses for years, and that's really ramped up during the pandemic. And so that's a big concern. You know, can I afford to rent in this town anymore? If I'm a line cook, I'm getting paid, you know, between $10 and $14 an hour, but my housing costs, you know, $350,000, $400,000 for a home. Similar issues, I guess, you'd be experiencing in San Francisco or New York, but happening in rural parts of the West. And then at a national level, polarization was also on everybody's mind. And I want to bring in some tape here from Ben Bardo in Du Bois, Wyoming.
It's way politically divided.
Have you ever seen something like this in your lifetime?
Never. Never this bad.
Where do you think it ends?
Revolution.
You think so?
I do. I think it's headed there. You know, the people are now waking up. They're tired of seeing what's going on in the cities burning under democratic rule. Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter, they aren't the only ones that matter. The Black Lives Matter is the most racist, progressive movement out there. And they're the, you know, they're cause of the destruction that's going on right now.
You know, Nate, I think that's a really important piece of tape to hear. It's interesting because I've actually been to Du Bois. It's a tiny little town. It's very remote. It's like 5.5 hours drive to Salt Lake City. And what you're hearing Ben Bardo say there is really what you hear Republicans say in almost any place around the country.
There almost seems to be a disparity between what's happening, you know, in someone's backyard, between what they're seeing nationally on TV. You know, Ben Bardo and others rely on Fox News and conservative talk radio for their information. And I think we've seen over the past few years a creation of boogeymen, whether it's Antifa or Black Lives Matter. And, you know, that might just be a political tactic for a president or elected officials. But these boogeymen are becoming really real for some folks. And it's surprising to see because, as you said, Bardo and others are literally hundreds, if not thousands of miles away from, you know, the cities that they're concerned about.
You know, to that end, I have spent many hours driving those roads in Wyoming as a reporter with Wyoming Public Radio years ago. And I'm thinking your point is to talk to people while you're there. But if you're riding a bike from, say, Du Bois to, I don't know, Laramie, for instance, you're going to be on the road for a really long time, just you and the pronghorn and the wind. I mean, what was that experience like to ride your bike through some of the most desolate parts of the lower 48?
Yes, it was incredibly lonely. And just saying pronghorn and the wind brings me right back, because there were moments where all you saw were pronghorn antelope and just like a intense headwind blowing into your face. I had a lot of deep conversations with myself on the bicycle.
And with your body, I'm sure.
You end up talking to your knee and your butt and all the things that are screaming at you in pain. So really, really by myself.
How much weight did you lose? How many flat tires did you get?
Oh, yeah. No, I lost less weight than I was kind of hoping I was going to lose, because I think I put that weight back on by eating a lot of burgers and drinking beer. Fritos and bean dip was definitely like my go-to food, because a lot of times you're not going to grocery stores because, as you said, these places are pretty far apart and you'll just go to a gas station and pick up whatever you can. And I had one flat tire at the worst possible time, which was there was a cold front, a snowstorm coming in, and I was trying to get down to Du Bois, Wyoming, and the tire kept going flat, and I'd pump it up and it would go flat. So I was being chased by a really intense snowstorm until I got to a little motel there.
Wow. So Missoula, Montana to Steamboat Springs, Colorado, 800 miles under your belt. What's your takeaway? What'd you learn on this trip?
I got excited about America again. I think that we're a quilt of all these little towns all stitched together. And right now there are forces that are trying to pull that quilt apart. And it is fraying. But we have a lot more in common than we like to think, or that we believe we do. And I think that we could benefit by paying a little bit more attention to what's happening in our own backyards and less attention to the national news and the really divisive rhetoric that's happening during this election.
Nate Hedgie, host of the new podcast Facing West from the Mountain West News Bureau, biked 800 miles through four western states in August and September, talking to people about the country, about the election. We're going to link you to his work at hereandnow.org. Nate, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
These are tough times for small business owners. Even before COVID-19 hit, independent booksellers were struggling to match Amazon's prices. Amazon has doubled profits during the pandemic and added thousands of jobs. Kalima D'Souza is an indie bookstore owner who seems undaunted by big challenges. She opened Cafe Con Libros in Brooklyn, New York in 2017, when odds were already against small bookstores. She also had a full-time job in social work, and she was pregnant. She launched the business, though, just the same.
There's many different reasons. I came to this from a particular point of, I think it is really important that women, if you are ever in a position to do so, pursue your dreams and pursue it with every inch of who you are. So many of us work and we don't love the work that we do. I happen to love being a social worker. I happen to love being part of the Silberman School of Social Work community. However, I'm lucky to be able to do that. I have a lot of friends who are working because they need to pay bills, not because they love what they do. And so what I always say, you build your life and then you build your career around your life. You don't build a career and then build your life around that career. And for me, the bookstore represents me pursuing a dream that is not my source of income, is my source of joy.
So how hard have you been hit by the pandemic?
It was really tough in the beginning. We could have stayed open because we're a cafe and we sell food and coffee. But we decided not to because we were very, very sensitive about what it could do to our community. And out of community accountability, we closed. So that meant that a lot of my money from my full-time job was being channeled into the business to keep it afloat. So it was very, very tough. But I'll tell you this, it also really toughened me up in terms of forcing me to pivot in very strategic and intentional ways to meet the needs and demands of the community. And I also had to help them to really understand what it meant for them to invest their money into us. When they buy from us, it's an investment.
So how did you pivot? What did you do?
We started to sell coffee online. They can buy a whole bag of coffee online and we would have it shipped directly to their homes. We upped the ante on our subscription. We have a subscription service that's $20 a month. And we mail the book directly to their homes. So, and that's the cheapest we can go. We barely make any money off of that. But what we were betting on is if we had volume, even if we made $1 or $2, if we had volume of people, we would make some money and we would keep it at a reasonable price. So $20 for a book being mailed directly to your home, that's great. If you ask me,
how's it worked out?
It worked out wonderfully in the beginning. We started in January and in March, we had about 200 folks. And then by June, we had 600 folks. And it's tapering off because now the folks who were not initially hit by COVID unemployment are now being hit. So people are losing their jobs. They are saying that they can no longer afford it and are sort of unsubscribing. However, when we were at the height of things, we had about 600 people on our subscription service.
You sound like kind of a never say die person. Do you think you're going to pull through this?
Absolutely. I think, you know, absolutely. I want to say this, Lisa, and I think this is maybe something that I'm not sure if, you know, you want to cover, but during the summer when George Floyd and Breonna Taylor at the height of the Black Lives Matter movement, a lot of Black owned bookstores received tremendous support. And it was bittersweet. It has been bittersweet for all of us. We hate the fact that our bookstores are now thriving. Some of us are thriving because of Breonna Taylor and because of George Floyd, that another Black body had to be laid to rest so that folks can wake up. And one of the things that happened was this whole movement for buy from Black-owned bookstores. And so the money that we made from that, we are reinvesting in finding ways to reinvest in our community, but also putting that away for what seems to be another resurgence of COVID-19, specifically in New York. And our zip code may be one of the zip codes that gets shut down. So if that happens, and God is forbid that it happens, that we have a little bit of money to get us over the hump. And I also have my full-time job. So I'm prepared to fight. And no, I don't give up. I spent my formative years in the United States Army, and we don't give up.
Really nice to talk to you. Thank you so much, and we wish you best of luck. Kalima D'Souza, owner of Café Con Libros, a feminist bookstore in Brooklyn, New York.
Oh, wait, I do want to say this one thing. One of the things that I really want to stress to folks is that shopping from indie bookstores is not a one-time thing. It's not in response to this campaign. What we're asking for is that people be committed to their independent bookstores and that they become part of the life and blood of those bookstores, subscribe to their emails, read their blogs, go on social media, be part of the community. Because when you are really committed to the actual bookstore and not just to responding or reacting to a campaign, then being able to survive hardship becomes much easier. Quick responses or reactions are just in the moment, and that's not long-term sustainability.
Thank you, Kalima.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. You're listening to Here and Now.